On the 2nd of December 1980, so I'm going to date myself for you nicely now, I, with fear and trembling, opened my results from the General Nursing Council, which said that I had indeed passed my state final examinations, which was a surprise not only for me, but also for the tutors that I had, who used to regularly draw up a list of those they knew would definitely pass, those they knew would definitely fail, and those who were in between. And I was on the list of three or four that were on the in-between. What was even more of a surprise was when I phoned my parents to let them know, and my father, who was a church attender, and in fact was a church organist, but wasn't quite sure where he stood at that precise moment of his life in terms of his standing with Christ, turned around and said, "Well, you could go and be a missionary now, couldn't you?" And I'm thinking that was the furthest thing from my mind, although I had some interest, a little bit of interest, but it wasn't what was on my mind that day. The fact that I had simply passed my examinations was the greatest thing for me. So how do I then end up going on big ships like this, which, by the way, weigh 16,500 tons, for those of you who are nautically minded, means nothing to me, but it's 23 metres wide and 156 metres long, which is a little better, and has about 8.5 decks, and is where I spend about 3 months of every year, and have done for the last 6 or 7 years. That journey is a long and convoluted one, and I won't bore you with all the details, but it did take me about 28 years from the time that I felt God was calling me into the mission field, which was not the day I got my state final results, but the day from when I felt God was calling me into missions of some sort, before I was actually able to go and do missions. And yet, those 28 years, like Moses had 40 years preparing, I had 28 years preparing. And actually, I wouldn't be able to do what I do now if I hadn't had those 28 years of life experience, not just as a nurse, but also in terms of moving around a little bit, around the country a little bit, of having family, having children, and so on. But the one, when I was thinking about what I would say to you this morning, because it's going to be a slightly potted version of what I do, the one verse that really spoke out to me, where I've been reading recently, was in Leviticus. And it's Leviticus chapter 6 and verse 13. And it's when God is giving all these commands to Moses about how the people must live. And this is one of the commands that he gives to Aaron and his sons. And he says, the fire, that is the fire which burns the offerings and the sacrifices, the fire must be kept burning on the altar continuously. It must not go out. And really that is a theme that runs through, because if we think about the Old Testament sacrificial lamb, and Christ being the New Testament sacrificial lamb, that's what that is relating to. And it's about the fire, and the fire being on the altar of my heart. That altar is my heart, and that fire within my heart must not go out. And that fire is prayer. And through all these journeys that I have done, I would say the one thing which stands out over above everything else is the way that I have seen God answer prayer in all sorts of different ways. And so let me just take you on a little journey. Don't be worried about the sheaf of papers. There's one slide per sheet, so it's not going to be too long. Okay. But Africa Mercy, I was working with a colleague down in Gloucester, at the private hospital where I was working, and she kept disappearing for 2 or 3 weeks, and then she'd come back and she'd tell me a little bit, and eventually she turned around to me and said, "I think you'd really quite enjoy it." So one of those quiet evenings at work, and I was stood in recovery just waiting for the ward staff to come back and collect a patient. I'm on the computer and I find myself going to the Mercy Ships website. And before I realise what I've done, I've sent for a pack to volunteer. And that resulted in June 2008 with me going out to the ship for the very first time when it was in Liberia. And as a consequence of that, I have been. At the moment, the ship actually is neither in Benin nor Cameroon. It's on the sea. And it's sailing up to Tenerife. When I first went to the ship, I did my job as a scrub nurse. And when I went back a few months later for another 3 weeks in October when they were short of staff, I went back again as a scrub nurse. And then I went back in January 2009 and I stayed there for 6 months. Trust me, my husband is a very long-suffering and being very gracious and recognises God's calling on my life and allowing me to go off there for 6 months. He did come out and see me while I was there. But I was in Benin for 6 months and then I started doing anaesthetic work. Anaesthetic work on the ship is very different. It works on an American system, so I don't have a nice anaesthetic room where I can go and get set up. I have to set up in the operating room. And we had vastly, vastly different cases to the sort of thing I was used to seeing. And that actually has enhanced my skills hugely. So it's a two-way thing. But the ship often has patients that not only would we never see in medicine here, because patients would go to the doctor much sooner because they have that availability to go to a doctor, they're also much more advanced and just much more difficult. And so the skills required are huge for doing those sorts of things. But we see God answering prayer. When you have a man who has the biggest tumour I think we ever took off anybody, who required 17 units of blood, which meant that we had to have 17 crew members who were willing to give blood. And he stood up in the community meeting a month later when he was just about to go home to come and say thank you to everybody. We don't often bring patients into the community meeting. It really is just for all the crew who are serving on board ship. But just occasionally we have someone like that and they want to come and say thank you to the crew. That was God's answer to prayer. He had not only given his life to Christ, but his life had literally been saved physically as well as spiritually. So in August of this year, the ship will be sailing into Cameroon. It's a new country for us all. The ship has never been there. There is an advance party there at the moment. And while I am there, I am going to be doing what I've been doing the last couple of times that I've been on the ship now, when I go for 3 months, and I go and teach about a checklist. Okay? Doesn't sound very exciting, does it? But this actually involves me travelling around the entire country with a small team. I take a couple of anaesthetists with me, and a couple of translators, and we go into the regional and the bigger district hospitals of the country as requested by the Ministry of Health in that country, and we go and teach them about how they can improve the safety of the patient in the operating room. There are lots of facts and figures, but suffice to say there are nearly 240 million operations done every year throughout the world, of which about 1 million people will lose their lives simply from having the operation in an unsafe environment or because things were not done as they should be. And so by teaching them how to use a very simple checklist, we can make sure that the patients are kept much safer. And this is always interesting. We go to the hospital, we're there for 2 or 3 days, and we teach them about keeping patients safe, about going through a checklist. In the same way that a pilot on an aeroplane, and if you ever fly off anywhere, doesn't matter whether it's a 4-seater plane four-seater helicopter or the latest 500-seater A380 Airbus. Okay, the pilots all go through a checklist before they take off. And essentially that's what the checklist is. But we also teach them other things as well, which are related to that checklist, such as counting swabs. Now, I'm not sure how clearly you can see on this slide. We were in a hospital in Madagascar, right down at the very south in Fort Dauphin. And there, the staff decided that rather than just having a small sheet of paper, which they could write on, we laminate it and they can write on it and wipe it off, they would simply use permanent marker and write it up on their white tiles because everybody could see it. And it's about adapting to the task that we have to do. At a mission hospital in Benin, where I was in September through to Christmas last year, this hospital group added prayer onto their checklist. So we'd get the patient in, do some basic checks, make sure what the whole team is there, go through another checklist, make sure we've absolutely got everything we need. And at the bottom it said, right, let's pray for the patient. And so they added prayer onto their checklist. And it's always exciting to see what sort of things are going to be added onto a checklist and what doesn't need to be added. It always saddens me when some of the things that we have to make sure of on their checklist are things like the fact that they have the enough fuel to run a generator if the power goes off, or that they actually even have enough oxygen in their cylinders so they can do the operation. Do they have the basic medicines that they require to do their surgery? Part of the training as well is, or a lot of the training, puts us into simulations. And actually this is me being a patient in a university hospital in Parakou in Benin. And here I even had an arrest. So my two anaesthetic colleagues decided with the training that they had done with the anaesthetic staff that they wanted to see what they would do if a patient arrested on the table. They had the courtesy to warn me that I was going to have an arrest. And I actually had somebody bouncing up and down on my chest lightly. They weren't quite sure what to do, but they thought they ought to do something. And so we have a lot of fun. But at this particular hospital as well, I had another group of surgeons and anaesthetists from the local military hospital. And having been and seen the commander there, before we actually started our training, we were there over the weekend and went and met with him. And I'm not frightened of army staff. They don't frighten me. I grew up in a military family. It's not something that scares me ever. Went and chatted with him. He said, well, you know, we have our own system and we do this. I said, oh, great. I said, well, let's just sort of see what happens if we can share some good practice. You know, just come and see what we have to say. And I hear now that he is the greatest advocate for the checklist in that hospital. I suppose being the commander kind of helps, what he says goes. But actually, he learned a huge amount. But that was also through prayer, before we started the training, praying that he would be open to new suggestions. Some of the other things that we've done as well is to, as an organisation, Mercy Ships have completely changed operating rooms. Now this, believe it or not, the top photograph, my side of the screen, was the state of all the operating rooms in a university hospital in Madagascar. Mercy Ships coordinated with another organisation called Medical Aid International, and we went in and we completely refurbished two of their operating rooms. And actually, we refurbished four but only kitted out two complete ones because they just didn't have the throughput of surgery really to justify us doing all four. And having got the operating room changed, we then started doing some training with the local staff. The bottom corner, we managed to get them a whole load of new instruments as well, and refurbished but very good quality instruments. And there, my colleague from the ship, Jen, has got all these instruments out, working with the theatre manager and the operating room staff there to to see what they could use and how they would put it all together. Now, one of the great things about living on a ship is community life, especially when you return to the ship at about probably about 10:30 one night, having had a nice Indian meal out with a couple of friends, and we go down to the operating room department because we had heard rumours, and when we got down there, the rumours were true, sadly. Somebody had managed to hit a sprinkler, and when the sprinklers on a ship empty or put water into the department, they do it at extreme speed, and you get a lot of water in the space of about 2 minutes. And so the whole department was flooded out in the sterilising room. And so we had a team of us, not all nurses. I had one of the people we'd gone for dinner with that evening was one of the deck administrators and the dive master. But he was taller than me, and on the ship the bulkheads are not very high. I had him washing the ceilings for me at about 1 o'clock in the morning, so that we could get everything ready. This happened, thankfully, on a Friday night, but we had to re-sterilise nearly all our instruments. And even at 1:30 in the morning, it's always an opportunity to be able to teach somebody about what they're doing, and actually teaching a new member of the sterilising team how a particular piece of kit needed to go together, ready to be sterilised. Oh, sorry, that's the one. Sorry. That's all the instruments being sterilised at 1:30 in the morning and teaching. I wear a size 6.5 glove. The surgeon wears a size 8.5 glove, and he has his hands around the head of a 5-month-old baby, and he's just about to repair the cleft lip on that baby. This particular surgeon, Dr. Gary Parker, has been on the ship for 27, 28 years. He went for 8 weeks. He's still there. He met his wife. He's had two children who've both left the academy, which is on the school. But for every single patient, he is following his normal routine. And what he's actually doing, having got the breathing tube into the baby and done all the marking up and the drawing on the face that he needs to do before he starts the surgery, he stops. And the whole room actually stops, and we pray. Every single patient is prayed for before they have surgery on the ship. So that's a little bit of what I do with Mercy Ships. I haven't got any gruesome pictures. That's the most gruesome one I have, I think, on this entire show. So how do I get into what I now do a lot of, which is what we call disaster response? And I make no apologies for this story, and he's heard this story many times before. I used to run a guide unit, and one afternoon I remember phoning up Bob James and sort of saying, oh, can my guides come and work in the warehouse one evening? We've got our shoeboxes, but I quite like them to come and see the bigger part of the operation and see all the shoeboxes, and we can help check the shoeboxes in the warehouse. And he goes, oh, yeah, fine, great. Just about to put the phone down, he says, oh, by the way, beware of anyone who says, by the way. Because literally 4 months later, I found myself on my first DART response. And DART stands for Disaster Assistance Response Team. And I was asked to, I filled in application forms and did all that sort of stuff. But then was asked to go out to Haiti during the cholera crisis. So if you remember in 2010, Haiti had a bad earthquake and a lot of Port-au-Prince was just flattened. And there was a Samaritan's Purse had gone in response to that, and there was vast, vast miles and miles and miles of blue tarpaulin in and around the Port-au-Prince area, all with the Samaritan's Purse white logo on it. And then cholera hit. It started off much further north, but worked its way down. And you can, if you watched it, you would see it following the river. And so I ended up in Haiti. I went out there 3 times, in fact, for 2 to 3 weeks each time. And of course, one works with people from other countries, which is great. Same as on the ship. The ship has anything up to about 35 different nationalities on it at any one time. But in Haiti, I was working mainly with Americans. There were one or two Brits, not many of us. When we are there, we hold the Union flag high and proud. But news got back and someone was looking to try and put a team together of operating room staff. Now, apparently, we're a bit more like hen's teeth in disaster response world. And trying to find good operating staff who are able to work in lots of different situations is a little bit harder. But they were trying to put a team together for South Sudan, where they wanted to do a cleft lip program. And I was invited, because the word had got out, somebody had asked a question in an office, oh, we need somebody. And this girl said, oh, but I work with somebody, a Brit, who was there, and this is what she actually does for her normal job. She'd be great. She'd be really good. She'd really love it out there. And I have to say, I was very saddened this year that because of the political situation in South Sudan, I couldn't go out there to do the cleft lip program. It is my favourite 10 days anywhere in the world. South Sudan itself is a dry, dusty, very poor country with wonderful, lovely people there and children who are just adorable and who have many, many problems, one of which is cleft lip, and we are able to repair the cleft lip on these children. I think our record in our program was that we actually did 90 in 1 week. We do drive our surgeons quite hard, but it is my favourite activity ever. But this is all with Samaritan's Purse. And so you get known and you sort of do the stuff with the cleft lip team. And while we were in South Sudan in the October of 2013, a typhoon hit in the Philippines. And this is when I kind of questioned, which country am I in? I literally got home from South Sudan on the Monday and I flew out to the Philippines on the Friday, I believe, or something like that. It was a remarkably fast turnaround to go out to the typhoon in Philippines. You'll see that we called it Haiyan, the locals called it Yolanda. And Samaritan's Purse went and we asked the Ministry of Health what do they want us to do, where do they need the help. Now, after a disaster like this, it's always much more difficult because everybody's asking the same question. And what they asked us to do was to go and set up and to help out a schistosomiasis hospital in Palo, which was about a 30-minute drive south of Tacloban on the island of Leyte. And so we went out there. We helped them to clear the site. We even had some Marines come and help us erect some emergency tents, which on the outside were brown, but on the inside were nice and white. And we had boxes and boxes and boxes to unpack. But again, you know, even in these situations when you're working under quite a lot of pressure, really, and it can be quite stressful, suddenly you've got a team of people together and we are all there for the same reason. And the one thing that we are all able to do, and we do frequently throughout the day, is that we will just pray together. And we don't make a great show of it. It's just like, hey, you know, this isn't working. Okay, let's pray about this. And we just stand where we are and we just pray about it. And we get to meet some good people. The Marines were a great crowd to come and help us. But also the staff, you know, the Filipino staff, it was wonderful being there because the staff were so keen and so wanted to help. They were not expecting anybody to just hand things to them. And they actually left this wonderful sign saying thank you for coming, helping and inspiring us to stand serving people affected by Typhoon Yolanda, which is how they called it. And so worked at the Schistosomiasis Hospital. I was there for a few weeks and then you realise you've actually got one or two more medical staff than perhaps we actually needed. at that precise time. At that moment, Samaritan's Purse didn't have an emergency field hospital with operating rooms. Other people did that. And so we were setting up and going out and doing mobile clinics, all those sorts of things together. So you really do have to be flexible. Because what I then next got asked for was, oh, could you just come and help us put 8,000 hygiene kits together? Like, you know, in about 3 days. And so, okay, I think I can do that. What do I do? Well, you've got to set up a you know, like an assembly line. So a quick phone call home to a husband who is very used to running factories. Do I move people or buckets? Was the question I believe I asked. And I got told you move the buckets. We moved the buckets. I set up two assembly lines either side in the grounds of what had been a beautiful hotel right by the coast. And it was just ruined, completely ruined. But the staff there, of course, were now out of work, were happy to come and help us do some work. And I was trying to work out how I was going to put all these different items just into a bucket. We put things like rice cookers in. We put things like toothpaste, toothbrushes, bars of soap, toilet rolls, sanitary products, plates, spoons and forks, cups. How do you get all that into a bucket and then be able to turn the lid upside down so that you can then stack them? Because we had to stack these, and I stacked them five high and headed up a team for doing that. And we had, again, here we had an excellent team. And this is some of the team that I worked with. And most of those people are still serving with Samaritan's Purse today. And it's a great joy and privilege when I go on a dark response to be able to be with them and to be able to pray with them and to work with them. And then we had the nasty little virus called Ebola that hit. And I was asked to go to Brussels and to train in how to deal with Ebola. So they did indeed train me. And I'm actually there tying up somebody else who was just too tall. He had to bend over so I could actually reach where I had to get to. And having trained me, they then sent me to Elwa base in Monrovia, in Liberia, and I stayed there. But actually, I was then asked to go and run a community care centre in Zorzor. Now, I actually don't have any photographs, particularly of the community centre. I do have a photograph of where I lived. And this is the wonderful world of being a missionary. Okay. So this was at 1,500 feet above sea level, so it's a bit cooler than other parts of Liberia. So much so that actually some mornings I actually needed a jacket on first thing in the morning. Bearing in mind I'm in Liberia coming towards Christmas. I had one tap that worked. I did have a small gas cooker which operated on LPG cooker. So I was able to make myself a cup of tea, which was important to me. Having tea is very, very important. The other side of the compound that this house is based in, right round the other side, I had seen a couple of Marines. I hadn't really thought too much about it. And then they started building a full site. The community care centre that I was going to run was like a mini Ebola treatment unit. But then there was an organisation which was building a full-sized Ebola treatment unit on literally the other side of the road from us. And the Marines were there helping. They have like a civil arm. They're all in uniform, but it's like a civil arm. And they were there. And they came to see my community care centre just to see what it was like. Discovered that we lived on the same compound. It decided that was a good enough reason for them to come across. And we shared tea and biscuits and things together. And actually, this is just give you an idea of sort of the temporary nature sometimes of some of the things that we have to work in. And there's some of the team that I was with John McCaw, who headed up the team building the community care centre. And then we have to get to work. So I got to work in a number of different ways while I was in Liberia. So a Chinook, I'm not sure what the other two are, but I know that they are considerably smaller. And then I also had a motorcycle. I'd get one of the lads would come out on a motorbike to come pick me up and actually take me from the house to the community service centre. And the view, I have to say, if you're in a helicopter, the view from 1,800 feet up can be pretty cool. And again, a Christmas treat. We were given a Christmas treat by Samaritan's Purse. I was actually there for Christmas. And again, great team of people. And when you're working in a very challenging environment, which, trust me, working with Ebola is, being able to have a little bit of fun together on Christmas Eve is great. And the two young men in the top photographs had had their bow ties made for them by the young ladies who were stood next to them. And we were just able to go out and relax a little bit. But with this team as well, we met together regularly on a Sunday night in one of the houses on the compound. It'd be a different house each Sunday night. And we'd kind of have our own Bible study, time of prayer. We'd always we would share a meal together. And it was just that time to make sure that we were all connecting with each other and that we all had time to share something of Christ for each of us. And then in 2016, the very first field hospital came out and was established in Ecuador following the earthquake in Ecuador. It had a small lab, had a pharmacy, and it also had, that's the inside, it's a trauma bay, with a small ICU at the far end of it. It's the first time we had deployed it. We didn't have quite the same facilities that we do now. And the operating room was just a single room with a small sterilising room at the back. And again, it's about building team. It's all about the team. And while we were in Ecuador, one of the doctors was related to people who make the proper Panama hats. And we often find we are bowled over by the generosity of the people that we go to work with and to go and serve with. And the people of Chone had wanted to do something for us in the community where we were supporting a local hospital which had been damaged so badly that they had to move out of their premises. And they had had seven operating rooms. Now they only had three in little mobile units. And so we were able to help them out and to set up this field hospital on the edge of the town and on a large football field and to get things moving. Those people wanted to be generous, and so they actually measured us all, and we all got our very own Panama hats. But again, what also do we see there? We'll see very often a huddle. Now, this is a handover huddle. So it's night staff handing over to day staff. But what they are also doing in the middle of that huddle is that they are actually praying for each other, praying for the staff who are going to go to sleep, that they will get some sleep, even with all the heat of Ecuador, and also for the team who are coming on, that they will be able to cope. One small story from Ecuador is this young man, Sergio. He'd had a bad car accident. He'd had to have a traumatic amputation at the roadside, and he came in, and he was in and out of our operating room. But what he saw were nurses who were different. While he was in the hospital, he had nurses who really did care for him, and he just saw a different way of life and was something that he wanted for himself. And actually, what you can see here is Sergio reading his own Bible. He gave his life to Christ, and he was given a Bible. And so my last deployment has been to Iraq. We do call it a deployment, a bit military, I guess, but that's what they're called. And this is the emergency room, which was set up, another emergency field hospital set up, this time with two operating rooms. And this is where our patients come in. And when we triage patients, it's kind of saying, okay, well, this is the worst, walking wounded, So how do we do it? And into this room came the patients who really needed our help, that we could really help with. And just in case you wonder where we were, this is where we were. Again, having a little bit of fun. Okay, it's how we de-stress, if you like, in the operating room. And so just talking about, if you turn your head upside down, they've actually taken the photograph outside the sleeping quarters that we had there. But here then in the operating room, you know, probably the single most important person ever in an operating room after the patient is the anaesthetist, because they're the ones that keep you alive, because they keep the oxygen going to the brain. And then I have a team. The whiteboard was my work sheet, and on there I would write patients' names, the details, what surgery we're going to do. And surgeons were not allowed to write on the whiteboard unless I gave them express permission, because otherwise things got into a horrible mess. But it's about leading a team, and I had an absolutely outstanding team in Iraq. I was doing something, as I have so often with these things, where God has really challenged me. Being in this sort of environment, you know, Iraq, we were 20 kilometres, so the field hospital is still there. It's about 20 kilometres away from Mosul. And so literally, as we are busy operating and trying to put people back together again, sometimes we can feel the earth shake as mortars are being fired off in towards the west side of Mosul. All very new work. But God has very much enabled me to do this work. You know, he doesn't call the qualified. He qualifies those he calls to work for him in his kingdom. And probably one of the hardest parts in being in a leadership role at all is the need to keep that fire burning bright in my own heart. And we come back to this verse in Leviticus 6:13, where God's instruction was that the altar fire must be kept burning continuously. It mustn't be allowed to go out. And in these situations, what we value most are the prayers of those people at home who pray for us. So when I send those weekly newsletters out, and I'm asking, you know, for those of you who do, please pray for. I try and be very specific, but actually, you know, just sometimes even we don't know what to pray for. Sometimes we're in situations which are so difficult, we're faced with some horrendous choices at times. No one likes switching off a life support machine on a 9, a 10-year-old. No one likes seeing a 1-year-old with their legs blown off. And sometimes all we can do is ask God to hold us up in prayer. And to, if I can ask you, you know, sometimes you don't know what to pray for. Ask that God would just hold us up in prayer. There were times, I have to say, when I was in Iraq, I went out and I shouted at God. And I did shout, "This isn't fair. This child does not deserve this." But I also knew on the other side that God loves and cares for each individual person. And it was only God who gave me the strength to be able to face some of those challenges when you're laying somebody out in the operating room. It's something we very, very rarely do in an operating room. Very rare for us to lose patients in an operating room. But being gentle, caring, loving for each patient, washing them, I discovered very quickly the need to be able to wash patients was really, really important. And I had my own personalised, heavy-duty plastic apron, personalised basically because I'm so short. The others, they were all too long. But to be able to wear that, to put gloves on, to be able to wash patients and to wash not just their feet, but their whole body, taking care as well of those who had died. But we also had other things that happened as well. And there's a very tall gentleman in the middle with very white shoes on. And his nickname is Pokey. And during a quieter week, a slightly quieter week, Pokey was able to deliver his pearls of wisdom to us. So we called them Pokey's Pearls. And he would give us a 20-minute teaching session on all sorts of subjects. He was a trauma surgeon of many, many years' experience from California. It was interesting to see him leave in normal clothes, and he got the most fantastic tooled leather boots I've ever seen on any cowboy, I tell you. What you don't see on any of my photographs of the Iraqi staff, of Iraq, are Iraqi staff. And I worked with some wonderful Iraqi staff, different faiths who were Muslim, and one of them in particular used to come to work and he would wear a face mask, not because of germs, but because he couldn't afford to be recognised by the Iraqi people that we were caring for. We cared for Iraqi soldiers, we also cared for ISIS. We treat everybody who came to us. They were put in separate areas of the hospital. But in terms of care that they received from us as Christians, they received the same care. They are all God's children. And it's very hard, of course, obviously, with the things that have happened recently, to be able to hold on to the fact that I know that there are many Muslims who are not of that bent, who are not that way inclined. And but we couldn't afford to even put their photographs onto our photographs because it would put their security at far too great a risk. And so, much as I love the guys very much, we were not able to put their photographs on. So how can you help? Well, praying is probably the most important thing that anybody can do. The gentleman at the top there is a hardened Marine soldier. He has seen action in many different places. But he gave up his life as a Marine, came into security and came to Samaritan's Purse. And he is a real warrior. And he's actually praying by the bedside of one of the children who sadly we later had to turn the life support off on him. And the staff. Dear friend Kat, also praying with one of her patients. She didn't know who took the photograph. But also supporting us while we're out there, supporting us whenever you've got someone who's away. You know, I love it when I get photographs back and I've got things like my hanging baskets, or I've got the sheep doing daft things, or I've got, you know, pictures of the roses or something, or the daffodils, those sorts of things. I love that. But then perhaps my one piece of advice I'd give you when people come home, give them time. Don't forget them, give them time. Invite them around for coffee, but don't expect them to open their heart to you. Just invite them around for coffee. But if they want to talk, just listen. You know, Henry Nguyen said, "The friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us for an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face us with the reality of our powerlessness, that is a friend who cares." And that would probably be my one piece of advice to anybody when you get people who go out who then come back. There are many, many things that happen when I'm away that I find it difficult to process sometimes, and there are things that I never talk about when I come home. And that's some of those things are between me and God, and they stay there. But that's where I would leave that. And I just ask us, let's just pray this prayer together. And I'll read it out. Now let's just pray. May God bless us with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships, so that we may live deep within our hearts. May God bless us with anger at oppression and exploitation of people, so that we can work for justice, freedom, and peace. May God bless us with tears to shed for those who suffer from pain, rejection, starvation, and war, so that we may reach out our hands to comfort them and turn their pain to joy. May God bless us with enough foolishness to believe that we can make a difference in this world, so that we can do what others claim cannot be done. And the blessing of God, who creates, redeems, and sacrifices, be upon us and upon all whom we love and pray for this day and forevermore. Amen.